Welcome to Inscape Quest, where insightful conversations redefine perspectives. I'm your host, Trudy Howley. Join me as together we delve into discussions about relationships, work, and passion, unlocking profound insights that may shape our lives. This is Inscape Quest, where the journey within meets the quest for understanding. Welcome to my guest today, Jessica Greer. Jessica is a Grand Prix rider and trainer in Colorado. She's also a master's equine historian. Jessica has married these two passions, history and horses. And today we discuss the history of the horse. Jessica, welcome today. I'm so excited to have you here for this conversation. I've been wanting to talk to you for a really long time about the history of the horse. So I'm happy that we can get started today.
Me too. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So we have this wonderful co-evolution with the horse, which basically means that two different species have this intertwined relationship that have affected each other. And this co-evolution really is in every culture in history throughout the world, anywhere from Mongolia, Japan, Spain, Austria, Ireland, Argentina, Canada, France, South America, and so on. And that relationship continues today. Where do we start? There's so many different places to start.
There is. I think it's best to begin with where the horse, essentially, the horse is indigenous to North America, which is very unique because there was a period where they were not in North America. So the horse began in North America. And when I say this, I'm not talking about our modern horse that we would think of today, but a horse similar that becomes the modern equus that during the Ice Age went over the Bering Strait land bridge and spread into the Asian steppes. And there is where the first domestication of the horse occurred. And from there spread into areas such as Arabia and the Iberian Peninsula, where we see horse breeds such as the Arabian horse, Spanish barb, which to this day we can essentially trace all of the ancestry of our current horses that we ride to these lines. And the horse did not arrive back or wasn't reintroduced into the Americas until the Spanish came with their, I guess you would say, their voyages to the New World, where they landed first in the Caribbean islands with horses and then later in Mexico. And when the horse returned to its native area where it evolved, they just spread like wildfire.
And what we now know as North America then, that was in around the 15th century. And I think there weren't that many horses that came over then at that time.
No, I believe the initial number that they brought was 28, which they brought by ship. Which when you think about that, imagine a 3-month voyage across the ocean from Spain to Mexico. And these horses had to endure this and the storms. And they used crane to get the horses on, like a modified rope and pulley system to get the horses into the water off the ship. And they'd have to swim on the shore.
That's pretty incredible when we think about today that
horses fly
on planes. And what a important aspect of having well-trained horses these days to be able to fly easily and in comfort.
Absolutely. And other things that we have today, castration, a lot of that wasn't happening. So when these horses then were in these new lands, oftentimes they were left their own devices, so to speak. They're roaming. So you can see where some probably just wandered off and never returned and started their own bands of horses. And then from there, these wild horse populations erupted quite quickly. And out of that, it's where we see then later on this sort of horse culture that we think of when we think of the American West, of cowboy breaking, quote unquote, horses or taming these wild horses, or indigenous American who were equestrianized and had their own empire, which enabled them to have their own stance against the colonization that was occurring to them. So the horse was very significant.
I know that there's a lot of meaningful ways that Western cowboys and indigenous populations engaged with their horses. Understanding that capturing those Mustangs and taming them actually enhanced the prestige of the indigenous warriors, and stealing horses from the enemy was actually quite a noble way to get an animal. Is that right?
Yes. Certain indigenous nations, such as the Lakota and Comanche, they became who they were based on being equestrians. And in addition to that, they changed from being a sort of hunter-gatherer to this equestrianized, able to do more. They could hunt bison. They could become more warring against other groups. And groups such as Comanche had their own empire, so to speak. If you look at it from the standpoint of, they had their own interactions, their own territories, their own raids, slave trade, you name it, going on with, oftentimes working with Spanish colonizers and later French, and later when our country became America, American, which up until the Homestead Act, when people started pushing more west and European colonizers turned Americans, started moving westward, in which those lands were contested. And that the other narrative we hear about the cowboys versus the Indians in the Wild West. But the horse enabled those indigenous to stay on a bit longer than the groups of indigenous who were not equestrianized.
I'd love it if you might just touch on what we now know as the Western quarter horse and the breeding and how that evolved.
So I did research specifically surrounding the Colorado version, or the development of the quarter horse, and found that, so we had these Spanish horses who arrived in Mexico with Cortez that moved northward. So they're living in the areas of New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado. And in the east, Spanish were also in Florida. People in that area of the country referred to these feral horses that kind of escaped from the Spanish control. They called them Indian ponies. That was their term for these horses that indigenous peoples had. And later, if you think northern and east, Jamestown, New York, et cetera, these colonies that were the English settled, at this time that this is occurring in the Americas and England, they're developing what will later be the thoroughbred. So the English start bringing in the thoroughbred. So you see this unique mixture of these horses that are of Spanish descent, mostly Spanish barbs, then later the thoroughbred influence, and they merge together when we bring the events such as Civil War, push the populations more toward the west. And you mix these two populations then of the native indigenous ponies, which are now the Mustangs that we think of today, merging with these English thoroughbreds that on these borderlands are then being interbred. And at the time, it wasn't called a quarter horse. This is also a place where cattle are happening, and this cattle culture and the ability to move horses and cattle over vast distances. And you needed these horses that were able to have the stamina to do that, were able to be quick, and in turn develops into this unique breed that eventually becomes the quarter horse, the American quarter horse.
And you touched on the Mustangs, and I think it would be important to acknowledge that the feral population of Mustangs really is a controversial issue currently. And I'm wondering what your personal opinion or feelings are about the wild Mustang population.
So we have these feral horse populations in the Great Basin, which is parts of California, most of Nevada, New Mexico, Utah. And this land is regulated by the BLM, Bureau of Land Management. And this land has been a very interesting area. In the time of World War II, this is where, for example, there was atomic bomb testing going on. These populations of wild horses are running around out here. They've been there forever. There was a woman named Velma Johnson. This is back in the 60s. And she was, there would be regular roundups occurring because at the time, companies who would create dog food were like, we need meat for dog food. So we have these wild horses. We're going to round them up. We're going to turn them into dog food. For us, it's free other than the cost of the roundup. This woman, Velma Johnston, lived in the area and saw a truck, a semi-truck full of wild horses that had been rounded up, and saw horrible things, like a horse with a broken leg and blood is coming out of the trailer. And she was mortified. And she was like, this cannot be happening. In addition, there was a man, his name was Gus Bundy, which everyone, we joke, it's not Ted Bundy, the serial killer. Gus Bundy went to a roundup and he took photographs of the roundup. And these photographs got taken and published out of context from what he meant them to be, which then turned into this firestorm between Velma Johnson and the Gus Bundy photographs about horse welfare and how this can't be happening. This is wrong. This turned into a whole process, a legal process. Velma Johnson then coined Wild Horse Annie, and books, Marguerite Henry, who wrote Miss Eve Chincoteague, wrote a book. I forget the name of it, but her artistic works are based on these Gus Bundy photographs. And little girls writing their sender saying, stop the wild horse roundups. And eventually this law got passed where those ended. These companies weren't going to be allowed to round up horses, wild horses for meat. And the populations were going to have to be left alone, which was a good thing because, yeah, those shouldn't have been happening the way they were. However, now we are in a situation in present day where we have these uncontrollable populations of wild horses. And I say wild, they're really not wild. They're feral. They are a product of human influence. And I think that's a very important thing to note, is that horses and humans are so intertwined that you really cannot separate one from the other. We have created a situation where we have to manage these animals. And what's happening now is the land that they're on, they're indigenous to these land. So they're just going gangbusters. And there's huge populations that formerly were controlled, not in the correct way, by these companies. But now we've tried to find more humane ways to handle this. And now you have horses that are taken off these lands, that are now in holding pens, trying to get adopted out. But a lot of people don't, they haven't been handled. Very difficult to adopt them out. And then they end up standing in these pens with just bacon in the sun. And it's not really right either. So the question is now, how do we manage this problem now? Nobody wants to hear about horses being killed or being slaughtered. And that was another law, I think in 2008, that was passed about the horse slaughter in the US. And I don't think people realized how a lot of those horse populations are now just being put in trucks and shipped across the border. And then the same thing is happening. So in terms of trying to be more humane, we've added another step that's created more of an issue, and we still don't really have a solution.
This actually isn't the first time in our co-evolution where there's been complex problems in quest for progress. I know in particular, thinking about the industrial revolution growing up in the UK and learning about horses through the story of Black Beauty as well. Also all over the UK, but in Wales in particular, there were pit ponies that were used for coal mining. So there have been equine welfare issues for a long time. And I'm wondering if you might just touch on the role of the horse in the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. So there are scholars. So the narrative goes that we used horses as horsepower. We still use that term today when we talk about vehicles and say this engine has such horsepower. And that term was described to say with the new engines, which initially were steam or coal producing steam that ran these engines, and the term horsepower came from this engine is going to reduce you. This engine does the work of six horses or four horses. And there's a scholar who argues that instead of the industrial revolution occurring that made the horse obsolete, that the horse was actually the vehicle that enabled the industrial revolution. So there wasn't this, suddenly we had steam engine. There was horses who still had. So for example, when you had the train, you might be able to go on a train that was coal driven, but you had to take a horse-drawn buggy or an omnibus or some form of horse-drawn vehicle to get you to the train station, to get you onto the train. And other engines that were still manned by horses creating the energy to run this engine. And so there was, when this started to occur, more horses than ever, especially in America on the East Coast, moved into the cities. And so there was a statement that in Boston, a businessman in Boston would interact with more horses on a regular day than somebody in the American West in the early 19th century would. When you think about the West and cowboys and all this, this man in Boston going to business on his day-to-day job was going to interact with more horses than somebody out in the West, which I think is pretty profound when you think about that. And horses were in charge of everything. They were the taxi service. They were the mail service. They were the fire service. So there was in New York City, there was in the early 19th century, an outbreak of horse influenza that killed a lot of horses. And suddenly there was no fire protection because there was no horses to do this job. There was no horses to get the products from the stores, the train. There's the infrastructure with horse space. And this idea behind sanitation was very new with cities at this period. And there was cholera, human diseases that were occurring that no one really knew why they were occurring. And there were certain things surrounding horse disease that then influenced human medicine. So this kind of, at this point when horses were living in the city, we saw a rise of this notion of veterinary care, trying to see what's happening and how these horses are. Why are they getting sick and how can we prevent this? Because it's in the end costing money. And we have a garage nowadays where we store our car. So when horses moved into the city, what is now our garage was where you'd have your horse, like your horse that you owned. If you were a worker or if you were a cab driver or whatever, that's where your horse lived. So your horse literally lived in your garage. That was where they stayed. And then they worked 7 days a week doing their job. There was many things unnatural about this as they were on concrete or not even concrete, sometimes mud. There was a lot of manure. Manure issue was a huge deal. In some cities, you'll see sidewalks or entrances to houses where there's 10 stairs up and a concrete. And it's because manure used to go up that high because there was no way to clear this. And a lot of the time, if you owned a horse, if you were a working class and you had a horse and your horse got ill, you couldn't then use it for work. And then you didn't have any money to feed it because you weren't making money because your horse was sick. And so they'd just turn them loose into the street and then they would die. So horse carcasses were a very common sight. And eventually somebody would come along and take the body and then sell it. So there was a lot of not good things occurring with horses in the cities. And the horse bodies, they were truly living machines. Innocent. And when they were done. And so in terms of horse welfare, that was probably the most unnatural place for a horse to be living. Yet they so willingly were doing such. Horses are so adaptable in that way, which again, I think there's always that line. When we look at historical record, we see these numbers. We don't know who's making individual actions on horses, who is treating the horse well and who's not. Or what their knowledge was at the time. What we know now is significantly more than what they did back then.
I also want to acknowledge at the same time, there is a very significant population of working equids who are still the main mode of transport or the main mode of getting kids to school or carrying goods or creating income for families. And I did discuss this in relationship to donkeys in particular with Dr. Jane Merriam in one of my earlier podcasts. I think it's important to know there's still a lot of work that's going on in terms of supporting communities around understanding what equine welfare looks like among working horses and equids. And hopefully, as a community of horse lovers as well, we can continue to support that work.
And this is an interesting place where Black Beauty is a novel written by Anna Sewell, and it was published in 1877, and it was published in Great Britain. And this is also around the period of time slavery had come to an end. It was abolished. There's all this discussion about this new enlightenment period, so to speak, of how we're treating people. And she saw how horses were being treated as workers and said her whole premise was to write a book from the horse's point of view to create animal welfare and bring up this fact to say this is what it's like for these animals. That book then came to the United States and got published and spread everywhere. And it was part of the creation of groups such as the SPCA, and it spearheaded this idea behind these animals aren't just living machines. Like they're sentient beings, and they are like our families. We have to look at them that way. And I think as a horse person growing up, we all know that story. And to this day, if I read that book or watch the movie, I think that's very important that we are aware of that.
With that book, her writing was so powerful with this idea of inducing kindness towards horses in England. I want to name the fact that she was actually disabled as a young age, and she could drive a horse-drawn carriage. So there is this horse-human connection as well in terms of being able to travel. And I know that's one really important part of our co-evolution. We have this complex relationship with horses in terms of being able to travel, and that allows warfare as well as industry. Then there's this idea of the horse as this wild animal that's a symbol of divine freedom and transcend. They're almost paradoxical in many ways. I'm wondering, as things shifted from the Industrial Revolution and the sport horse came into being, what changed for the horse world in the Western world?
I think one of the biggest things is as horses moved out of cities, and this happened in the West too. So if you think if you think of the car replacing the horse in the city, the tractor replaced the horse in the West. So this idea that we needed horses to till land and create agriculture and move cattle, that in the train. Suddenly, tractors come along, they can till the lands, trains can suddenly move horses, you can move. And so in the West, rodeo up here. So horses suddenly are out of work, but there's these people who have these skills and these specialized horses that they bred for a specialized reason, going, well, what do we do now? And so you see these traditions being upheld in showcasing these things through competition. And that's in the Western side of it, on the English side of it. And it's a very interesting thing because as we are in the West, in Colorado, and as a dressage rider, there really isn't much dressage influence or history in the West. It's a Western place. Horses were in the cultures that they came from, and the specific places that they were bred for specific jobs started to change. And so we start to see horse racing had always been around. So if you had a good horse that you knew was fast, it would work all day during the week and then you take it to the horse race on the weekend. And that shifted into this specialized, we just race the horses for these specific races and then they go to stud. So now we have the Kentucky Derby where after 3 years old, essentially they're retired or maybe their career goes another couple of years. With rodeo, we see horse working, cow horse. And then these new branches, Western pleasure, and the breeding changes where suddenly horses are bred to move a certain way to attain these parameters that are placed in terms of how it's being judged. And then in the sport of dressage, same thing is happening. I think now we've specially bred horses to move a certain way to attain these things that used to take a lot longer to train through the gymnastics, you know, side of the horse's body. And now I think we a little bit have these horses that kind of are born able to move a certain way that prior horses 200 years ago or 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 20 years ago, even that wasn't a thing. And so I think we have a place now where we have the ability, we have the time, we have the money, and we have an industry that can say, here's what we want. How do we create it? And we've created things, but we have to then say, what are we doing with this? How are we maintaining this in a way that is sustainable and is honoring these animals? And these horses that are specialized breeding for sport are very different than the horses that are out feral out in these areas in the West. I really don't imagine any horse that I currently ride or train would survive for 50 long, turned out on their own. And that is a very human impacted thing. We have, as human beings, we have created now a species of horse that is dependent on us. And in return, we need to, it's a mutual relation. It's always been, both of us have been interacting this way, but now we have this luxury of excess in such a way of we're not having to get our food or water or build our stuff. We have all this machines to do this. So we go, oh, now we can do sport and make it all about sport, where it used to be probably 80% work, 20% sport.
I think it's interesting to note that, yes, horses would not survive out in the wild for sure. Yet horses survive in the hardships of the Namibian desert. It's like there's a constant, continual range of ways horses show up in different cultures in the world. In terms of the valuable economic aspect of horses as part of family life in working on farms, and then they were a valuable asset when they were perceived more machine-like, and they're a valuable asset as a sport horse. Do you have some thoughts about the economics of the horse industry as it currently stands?
It's always been there, and perhaps now it's more visible because the horses who were in the city or in the mines or pulling, doing the hard labor were a very different horse than the horse that the elite would have pulling their carriage when they wanted to go into town or go to church. If you look at that viewpoint or that lens, using the equine lens, you see a different way of looking at clad or valuing of horse. And this is where I think the breeding ties directly into this idea that started occurring in the 19th century with eugenics, this sort of false science that surrounding physical attributes that we then turned into a racist construct of certain people were valued over others based on their skin color, their facial shape, their where they came from. And this obsession of bloodline and purity and ownership of bloodline or purity, I think began or was going right alongside what was going on the human side of things and then with the horse side of things. And if you look at breeds in these different areas, if you go back to the Eurasian steppes as horses are spreading, these Arabian breeds, these Spanish barb breeds, a lot of the records about those times, interesting as an equine historian to look into this because there's not a lot of work done on this. Scholars really haven't examined this. As horse people, we take this for granted. But this actual written record of how things became a breed and what makes it a breed, what makes a quarter horse, what makes an Arab, what makes a warm blood. And just looking at Germany, for example, and when, or Europe, when you think about kingdoms and they had horses. And then there's alliances between different countries and they were part of their system of alliance. Saying, oh, I have this stallion. I'm going to give you this stallion as a gift. And they were able to infuse these bloodlines that became very nationalistic. These countries are very proud of the horses that they produce. So in America, we were producing American saddlebred. We were producing American quarter horses, the national show horse. And a lot of our horses were based on carriage driving. England was doing the thoroughbred, and they were primarily focused on racing, which was also tied into the Arab horse. And then Spanish horses, the Iberian Peninsula, it was based around cattle. When I say cattle, I know here we think about cattle in the West, but think of Spanish bullfighting. And I think the development of the horse breed based on the place where it was and the job that needed to be done, but then this nationalistic feeling behind these horse breeds and this pride of what you're producing and then this sense of ownership. And all these ideas then tie into who's better, what horse is deemed worthy of being seen, good for this job, which horse is good enough to just pull the carts around, and when their bodies break down, we're going to turn them loose and not think much about them again. And who's going down in the mine shaft? And I think you can see this hierarchy that we see in the human race as well.
I think as well, just naming all those different aspects, it's notable that in all different cultures and way horses have been a part of our lives, that there is this interconnected utility and also consciousness that can actually, I think, if we pay attention to it, I think horses can be a really important part of our healing, because there's this thread that we do have multicultural commonalities because of this co-evolution. And I'm hoping that actually can be a positive as we continue conversations around horses and they're a part of our psyche.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that the really cool thing about horses is that the horse is a unifier. So it doesn't matter who you are, what gender you are, how much money you have. It's like the horse equalizes it. Horses act the same way. They don't act on our human construct of things like that. They literally view us, these creatures that are saying, they're asking us, are you going to be a good leader? Are you going to keep me safe? Do you know how to communicate with me? And that communication, or if you're on their back, the ability to connect with them, you cannot create that. You can't buy that. You can't. That's something that is, it's unique in that anybody can achieve that if they're willing to listen. And I've seen it happen where people think, oh, I'm going to do this and this or buy this and this. It doesn't matter. And I think that's really special, is that. And I think it's the thing that draws horse people together, that horse people, the second that you've met a fellow horse person, you immediately, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you're from, who you are, what age you are. I remember being a little girl at 10 years old and some of my best friends were like older ladies in their 50s and 60s. And we would just talk for hours about our horses. And it's very special.
It is very special and such a privilege to be around. I think it might be important as well to share, in case we have non-horse listeners, just to define what the difference is between a horse that's domesticated and dogs and cats, because many people comment here and there on social media, really, what is the difference between a horse and the way we interact with dogs and cats as companion animals?
There's a few things. In terms of domestication, and I don't know this for sure, but I believe that dogs were one of the first animals that humans domesticated. But it's important to understand dogs are predators, and so are cats, and so are humans. In terms of the non-predator animals, it was goats, sheep, and cows that were the first animals to be domesticated. And the horses were some of the last. And a lot of that was due to the fact that humans early on, before they ever were interacting with horses, used to hunt them as a food source. And horses are flight animals. They are going to run if that's their first instinct, is to run. And in history, we have a term called agent. We talk about agency. When we talk about historical actors, we say who had agency, or meaning who has free will in the story. Horses are historical actors with their own agency, because you can't force a horse to do anything. They're way bigger than us. They are, like I said, they're flight animals. Horses make decisions to interact with us. They don't just say, okay, I'm going to do what you want. They're herd animals, so they definitely have this hierarchy where they will follow a leader. And that is one reason why they were able to be domesticated, is that we could create a situation where we as the human establish ourselves as the leader, that the horse said, yeah, I will follow you, I trust you. Dogs and cats they're truly a different animal. Horses are, as a predatory animal, or a horse that gets preyed upon, the fact that they are willing to enter into this relationship with us, they trust us, and they wouldn't. My whole job is based around this. The horses, if they don't want to do something, you cannot make them. And I think that this idea that somehow horses are obeying us through force, the people who do that, it doesn't work. And it undermines the entire relationship. And I think, unfortunately, in the case that's happening right now, especially our sport, is we see these people who are doing that. And I think then we see that they're getting rewarded for that. That is not what it's about. And I would say 99% of people are not doing it that way. And then I think stemming from that, we see this negative. And people don't understand what's the differences between what's good and what's bad. And that's not their fault. That's just a lack of education, a lack of transparency, a lack of understanding. And to have a sport that's been around for so long, equestrian sport, I think they entered the Olympics in 1902 or 1906. They've been around for a long time. And cavalry and all these things that stem from this. And a horse would not go running into a battlefield if it didn't trust you. It just wanted, it would turn tail the other direction. So I think that willingness to be a partner is really unique. I think that, like anything, when you're a partner with somebody, there's vulnerability and there's places where one or the other can do damage upon one or the other, but the essence and art of horse sport is to be the voice of the horse and lift them up the way they lift us up.
So appreciating the great harmony and pleasure between the horse-human relationship, and also acknowledging they do have their own free will, in terms of we as riders can actually feel on the edge of life and death with them sometimes because of them being flight animals, and you've got immense power that you may not be able to contain. I was thinking of it in the context of paintings of war horses, and how you often see horses with their mouths wide open, and almost like we should be fearing them because they're powerful and strong, and they look violent in many of those paintings. And I'm wondering how much of it is simply to do with just the riders pulling on their mouths with a bit that back in different eras was incredibly harsh.
So in terms of art, I haven't dived into the art side. I've seen these paintings. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've read a lot about, especially in places like ancient Greece and ancient China, we have archaeological sites in the chariot era with chariot wars, when before they were riding horses, when they had horses pulling these chariots and they were having these chariot wars. And the artifacts and the tack, and that, so they would have these ceremonies, they would bury the chariot and the horses with the warrior. It was, you could from these sites tell who was very important, because the more horses they had buried with them, the more chariots buried with them, the more important they were. And the tack was quite severe. The invention of the cheek piece, which nowadays we would say is what connects the bit up to the crown piece of the bridle, oftentimes there was spike. So the pressure from the bit would also be pushing into the side of the mouth. And a lot of the time these cheek pieces were made out of bone, or this is in the period of the Bronze Age. Virology was, you know, they were able to create metal. And then the bits were often bone and often also extremely harsh. Like nowadays, no, this would not be happening. And there's depictions of horses about their mouths foaming and their foaming red. And honestly, that, and as a person at that time seeing this, I'm sure that looked extremely terrifying. But the red foam was probably from literally cutting their tongue or mouth or lips from these harsh bits. And I think those paintings you're describing are men charging into battle with these contraptions. And yes, that would be a very, I can only imagine as a rider what you'd have to be doing to get around these situations. However, in this day and age, the invention of a saddle, the invention of the stirrup, and the stirrup was revolutionary. It was Arab influence the stirrup came from, and that's a whole nother area that I'm not super deep in understanding, but I have very surface level. In modern times now, we have the art of creating a saddle and the intricate saddles. Even back in history, they might not have been exactly formed to the horses, but we have saddles. If you go to museums, you see these saddles that were made. And a lot of our modern day saddles are based on the same idea with this wooden tree. And now we have ways to mold the saddle to fit the horse. We have specialized people who fit bit to the horse. We have our legislative bodies who say, these are the bits that you can use, these are the bits that you cannot. And there's a lot of research and technology that goes into these things that are only to make the horse more comfortable, that are light years beyond what we as human beings were doing in the beginning years. So I feel that our knowledge has only gotten better as we've evolved with the horses, and our awareness of how to make them even more comfortable, how to make things even better. Similarly to if you're hiking or skiing, I think of skiing. I grew up in Colorado. In the 70s, everyone came in their jeans and whatever. Nowadays, it's high-tech fabric. It's waterproof, breathable, gorgeous, and windproof. We have all these things now that we didn't have back when people were climbing 14ers and going skiing. Same thing with the horse. We have these new technologies that make everyone more comfortable, make everything easier. There's lots and lots of research that goes into that. I think we've only improved upon the equipment that we use. And then I think the factor that is always in there is the human agency to decide how we're using that. And I think that's where we have to understand that there are probably always going to be people that do things in a, they are going to use these tools in the wrong ways. And, but that we are, most of us, striving to not, to only improve and to only be better.
Absolutely. It seems reasonable to acknowledge the fact that horses are going to be in our lives continuously going forward, that they're not going to suddenly disappear or all of them become wild horses and be able to survive. So as we continue this journey with them and focusing on the humane and careful methods of interacting with them and enjoying them, there's so much more to learn from them. And I hope that other people can begin to appreciate that a bit more from understanding the history of how we got here. We touched on so many amazing
subjects today, and I know we could probably do a podcast on each little segment. So I think it was really wonderful to engage in this conversation with you today, Jessica. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in today to the Inscape Quest podcast. Please be sure to share this with a friend and check the follow button to get reminders of future episodes. Cheerio for now.